The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Myself to you completely. Buenos dias. Good morning. Welcome to Nature Nuggets on Radio Kingston. I'm your host, Dwayne, and I'm joined in the Midtown studio here with my co-host, Laurel Sutherland. Good morning.
Hello, everybody. Thanks, Dwayne.
Yeah, Laurel, you were on a trip and just got back last night, and you were on the other side of the planet. Where were you?
Well, yeah, night and day are a little confusing. I feel a little delirious. I flew in from Thailand yesterday, and I had the very strange experience of living on a global planet, where I left from South Korea at 10:30 in the morning on Friday the 28th and landed in New York City at 9:30 in the morning on Friday the 28th. So actually landed an hour before I took off on the same day. So I appreciate Dwayne for being in the studio to support me as I'm adjusting to a different time zone.
So here we are, Saturday, 10 a.m. in Kingston, New York. And as we do every Saturday with the community, we take a moment to discuss the more than human world around us, the multitude of life and experience that is so exciting, the biodiversity, the rich ecosystems, the processes that make everything possible for us. And so on Nature Nuggets, we really celebrate and expand this idea of community here in Kingston and the Catskills region to pull the experience and voices of the more than human into the conversation. And so we do that by bringing in naturalists and scientists and artists and conservationists and policymakers, anybody really who is focused on bringing attention to and uplifting the more than human into our daily lives. And, you know, we do this because we know that people won't fight for what they don't love, and you can't love what you don't know. And so we are going to start, you know, with this segment called Who's About Town. And Laurel, you've kind of ideated what this little segment is. So what do we do with Who's About Town?
Well, the idea of Who's About Town is it's kind of like the society pages of a newspaper, except we're talking about the more than human world. So, you know, we live in a region that has four super distinct seasons. Phenology is the scientific term for that, for the basically just the study of the progression of the natural world through the seasons. And so, you know, every week, so much has happened since the last week, you know, in the world around us. So, yeah, the idea of this section is just to share observations and reports of what you might see if you were to walk out your door right now, whether it's Midtown Kingston or deep in the Catskills, you know, what might be happening.
Today's March 1st, and just this past week, someone said, "Welcome to mud season," to me, and I was like, huh? And as kind of a relative newcomer to the East Coast, there's this little meme that kind of floats around, which is like the 12 seasons of you know, that really exist here. And there's, you know, false winter and the pollination, and mud season is one thing that kind of happens when it starts to warm up and the snow freezes, or the snow thaws, and then it might freeze again and just kind of cause a mess out there. And I was looking into it, and Catskill Mountain Keeper has a little page on their website about when is mud season, what is mud season. And one of the things they said is it really depends on where you are. But it really is when the snow begins to melt and the ground begins to thaw, there's always a great chance for mud. And so typically that's March through May. And so as we enter March, there's all signs of the changing season. Just earlier this week, I also heard a Carolina wren just singing their heart out in my backyard here in Midtown. And And so mud season too, it's not just about like being outside and the messiness of mud, but there's also, you know, the soils are at much greater risk for erosion, and new sprouting plants are really vulnerable to the compaction and the messiness of humans tromping around in the mud. And so as folks get out and experience the spring season, you know, be conscious of you know, the impact that we have when we are walking around on the thawing earth. Kind of before we turn to spring too, I had a really cool experience a couple months ago now, January, but thinking about before we leave winter, I was really fortunate to get out on the Hudson River in late January. It was the weekend of January 24th or 25th, I think. A colleague of mine at Scenic Hudson invited me out to this really cool event at the Athens Boat Launch, which is up in Greene County, just north of Catskill. And it is the skate boats, but it's the Hudson River Ice Yacht Association has this event, and these vessels are these essentially a skate that essentially a boat is built on, and it really requires some very specific conditions to have this happen. And so some of these boats, these yachts, you know, are from the 1800s, and so they're these wooden vessels, and they are meant to skate on ice but with wind, with sails. And so again, it's really hit or miss to have these conditions just right for these, for this event and for these really cool machines, really, or vessels to be deployed. And so there's a unique condition on the Hudson too, just north, right there in Athens. There's an island in the middle of the Hudson River, and so the Hudson is an active cargo channel too. So there's a lot of barges and the, you know, if it's iced over, there'll be a cutter that comes up and just opens up the channel for commerce and for boats to get through. But because there's this island, there's this side channel of the Hudson River, and that's where, because it's not broken by those icebreakers, that's where these ice yachts can just really fly on the river. So it was very cool to get out and see that. And all of these vessels, like, they almost look like, if you think of like Da Vinci's drawings of just these really fantastical machines. And so deep in winter, and I had heard about this before last winter and didn't catch it, and so I was really fortunate to check that out. Another kind of cool thing to do in winter here in the Hudson Valley. Some of the boats have really cool names: the Orion, the Whiff, the Hound, and you've got these really passionate people who take care of these old vessels, you know, 200-year-old vessels, and that experience, just seeing, you know, they let people get on and take them for a spin, and seeing these kids just and people of all ages just kind of with their face, you know, a foot off the ice, going, you know, very, very quick. And when they were built, these boats were actually the fastest vehicle on earth, because they would just take the wind and just the low friction of being on ice with being carried by the wind. So a very unique experience that's right here in winter for here in the Hudson Valley. And in winter too, and kind of the change of seasons, there are little signs. You mentioned phenology, but some migrations are starting to happen too. And what are some of the things that are starting to change here, if folks are getting outside?
Sure. Well, you know, of course, it is still winter, but today is March. Happy March, folks, which turns our attention towards the mud season and the spring. And interestingly, this week is the restart of the Hawk Watch. This is the 55th year where volunteers have been gathering at Hook Mountain, to the south of us, in the lower part of the Hudson Valley. There's multiple hawk watches that occur throughout our region, and a hawk watch is basically where birders have identified a strategic high point in the region, and we'll gather there to monitor really all migratory birds, but specifically raptors, birds of prey. And so this is on Long Path in Rockland County, and they just started it, and you know, good on them for these stalwart few birders who are willing to go out and start Hawk Watch in the end of February, because they saw a total of 2 eagles on the first day, which is the amount I saw yesterday on the train coming up from New York City. but then they did it again just a few days later, and also saw red-shouldered hawks. And so that is a sign that it is actually beginning, you know, that the trickle that's occurring this week will become a flood of and it's harder to observe songbirds. Songbirds usually fly at night, and of course they're small, and so you know with radar advanced technology you can see them, but the advantage of hawks and eagles is that they are often during the day and they're big, and so you can see them with your eyes. And they also saw dozens of turkey vultures heading north. And you know, turkey vultures, and also we have black vultures, 2 different kinds. You know, I think they're often you know, maybe overlooked or even worse, maligned by people because they can be considered kind of gross or something. But vultures obviously play, well, first of all, extremely important role, right? By the amount of you know, rot and decay we would have around us if the vultures didn't clean it up for us would be disfavorable. And even to the degree things like botulism and diseases that humans can get from, you know, they don't, vultures are immune to that. And so they do the dirty work for us. But I was fascinated just this yesterday getting home, looking out my window, and I saw a flock of probably a dozen or more turkey vultures circling. And I was wondering, is this migration? Is this, you know, and I looked into it a little bit, and it turns out that turkey vultures and black vultures basically a century ago were not here in New York. They were further to the south of us, and because of human-made changes, because of warming climates, because of trash heaps, roadkill, you know, they are now a permanent fixture in our landscape, and they are truly weirdos. They used to be considered, you know, related to hawks and eagles because they look kind of like that, but it's turned out when they did genetic testing that they have no relationship whatsoever. It's called convergent evolution. They're actually related to storks. And this is demonstrated by a few things. Partially, they got those ugly heads with the bare skin, so they can dig into a carcass without getting their feathers ruffled. And then they do a couple other just pretty gross things. And my intention is to convey an affection for some vultures, but I am going to tell you about a couple gross things they do. And one of them is that if you were to threaten a vulture or attack one, one of its mechanisms of defense is to take that acidic bile of half-digested carcasses and vomit it in your direction. And they can do some pointed vomiting of this acidic carcass. So don't try to attack a vulture. You may regret it. And the last thing I'll say about them is that one of the things that they figured out about a vulture, about, you know, how they're related to storks, is that they do live where it's often very hot, and birds can't sweat, right? That's a feature mammals can do. And so one of the ways that vultures and their progenitors, storks, have figured out to stay cool is to defecate on their legs. And the evaporation that happens is a cooling effect. So it's a very effective strategy, but not necessarily a very appealing one. But anyway, if you look up these days, even here in Midtown Kingston, you may well see the vultures circling. So while we might not want to cuddle them, they are worth appreciating for the vital role that they play.
Well, and interesting that you mentioned that they weren't here before. So just thinking about how ecosystems and habitat changes a lot with humans. And I was just reading on the Hudson River Almanac, which is a weekly digest of natural history and sightings of critters and events put out by the New York State DEC. There was a an entry from Mary Holland. And so this is put out by Tom Lake, who works with DEC, but a lot of the content is sourced from the public. So people out there in the world making observations and sending it to them. And a lot of times they can be really poetic, and sometimes they're really exciting of what people are seeing. And so there was an entry from Mary Holland, and I'll just read it. It's about gray squirrels. While the leafy, mostly summer nests, drays, D-R-E-Y-S, of eastern gray squirrels, Scurrius carolinensis, are more evident in winter since leaves have fallen from deciduous trees. These are not the primary home of these tree squirrels in winter. During the colder months, gray squirrels tend to retreat into tree cavities, old woodpecker nest holes, or natural cavities, which provides them with more protection from the cold, snow, ice, and wind than the leafy drays. The squirrels bring soft bedding into the cavities in the form of leaves, gathering them as the winter turns, usually in the late fall. In addition to providing protection from these elements, these cavity nests are where the first litter of newborn squirrels will be born come March or April. And just here in Midtown the other day, I was looking out my bedroom window early in the morning. It was probably about 7 in the morning, and there was a gray squirrel, because she lives there in this Norway maple in our backyard, and she crawled out of this tree cavity. So again, I was enjoying this entry from Mary Holland, because I can see the drays, you know, in the bare branches of the trees, but then I know that she lives in this tree cavity in the Norway maple. And she came out 7 in the morning. She looked really frustrated and annoyed, and it was cold, it had just snowed, and she came out, she was just nibbling on the ice on a branch, and she was so pregnant. So she was, you know, just after dawn, and this gray squirrel, very pregnant, and she looked really, really like not happy to be up. And then as it started to warm up and she was nibbling on the ice, getting a little bit of water, then all of these teenager squirrels came flying out of the cavity, and the look on her face, it was so motherly. She was, you know, this pregnant gray squirrel mom with all these teenagers just running around her, and then made me realize, like, yeah, she's going to have this new litter really soon, and then it'll be really fun to watch these little gray squirrels grow up in the backyard. So I appreciated the little vocab that Mary Holland brought, dray, which is the leafy nest. But thinking about migration too, is that I just read an article in Vox, but I guess eastern gray squirrels used to be number in the billions, and they used to migrate. They would follow the, you know, as different species of trees would put out their nuts and their fruits, they would, all of that fruit and food would give off the smell, and squirrels would just follow the forest, whatever was doing the fruiting. And they used to move by the millions across North America. And thinking about vultures being present now because of all of the changes, squirrels have, you know, have largely not, have become non-migratory because of some of the patterns and changes. And so made me think that these gray squirrels that live on O'Neill Street here in Midtown Kingston really are just there now. And so it's really interesting to think of how the alterations in habitat and in our own world really impact the way other species are moving around the world.
I really appreciate Dwayne telling this affectionate story about squirrel, because squirrels, for one, because it's been a bit of a journey, and there was an antagonistic dynamic between Dwayne and the squirrels to begin with, but also just because, you know, part of the whole point of this program is, you know, trying to bring voice to the more than human world and just kind of have appreciation for things that we might otherwise take for granted. And the squirrels are a great example of that. You know, it's so easy to just think of them as, I don't know, just a common thing, you know, that we don't give a second thought to. But, you know, I just had the opportunity spending time with colleagues from around the world who are interested in nature, but, you know, live in different places. And when I visit where they're from, I find this incredible amazement and delight in creatures that they're like, huh? that, like, oh, like, you know, like, yeah, that's a sunbird, like, they're annoying, or a myna, you know, and then when they come here, I've had friends from Indonesia be like, what is that? And I'm like looking, and I don't even know what they're pointing at. And I'm like, oh, it's a squirrel. Like, it's a squirrel, but they are like, that is the cutest, most interesting animal I've ever seen. And I'm like, you're from the rainforest of Indonesia. But because, you know, anything is exotic when we don't know it, and anything can be taken for granted when we're familiar with it. And you know, so much of the world that we're living in is like this snapshot of time. And squirrels are a great example of just the resiliency of life. As you're saying, they've changed as they've needed to, you know, to the new world we've created for them. But, you know, if you slow down and actually just watch a squirrel for a minute, they're fascinating
and delightful
and adorable and delightful. And they're usually, and they're doing things strategically and smartly, and sometimes not. Sometimes they're just sitting there being annoyed at their teenagers and they're pregnant and it's cold, and that's real too. And anyway, it's all just about realizing that, yeah, it's there's science to it, and then there's also shared experience on the planet with other living creatures.
Yeah. Well, so we are going to take a little break and hear some messages from the community, and we'll be back with Nature Nuggets in just a little bit.
Hi, I'm Amberly Jane Campbell from the Ulster County Executive's Office. As temperatures drop, the Ulster County Warming Center at Segunda Iglesia La Misión Church in Kingston provides shelter to anyone in need. The Warming Center is administered and overseen by the county and operated by the church and a coalition of neighbors and community members. This year, the Warming Center is now open continuously and will be through the end of March. Together, we're ensuring our most vulnerable residents have a warm and safe place to stay. The Warming Center is located at Segunda Iglesia La Misión Church, 80 Elmendorf Street in Kingston. For assistance or more information, call 845-334-0551.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices.
Many voices.
Many voices.
One community.
This is the Rev, Reverend Charles Stickley, inviting you to join me on Morning Meditation on Sunday morning at 7:30.
Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird.
We have music, we have the Word of God, we have a meditation, and we spend some time together to honor and to worship God. You're welcome to join me. It all takes place here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Mentor Me of Ulster County is hosting their Guiding Light Gala at the Senate Garage Saturday, March 8th. There will be small plates crafted by Tilda's Kitchen, a silent auction, and an awards ceremony honoring the 2025 Guiding Lights, both with From Within Mentor Me and changemakers who are making a meaningful impact on youth in the community. Tickets are $45 each, and all proceeds from the gala go towards supporting Mentor Me's youth programs, which provide mentoring, enrichment opportunities, and critical resources for children and families in Ulster County. Guiding Light Gala, Saturday, March 8th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Senate Garage, 4 North Street in Kingston. For tickets and more information, mentormeulster.org. Welcome back. If you are just joining the program, you're listening to Nature Nuggets, and I am one of your hosts, Laurel Sutherland, and we are being joined by our co-host today, Dwayne Martinez, who I appreciate is in the studio with us today. And we are having an elongated section today before we talk about other things of our Who's About Town. So we've been talking about, you know, what are some of the creatures, common or otherwise, that you might encounter if you are even in Midtown Kingston or if you're around the region. And we just talked quite a bit about squirrels, which actually are quite interesting animals when you really pay attention to what they're doing. They're mischievous and hilarious in many ways. And Dwayne mentioned something. Well, he talked about how the squirrels have nests which are more visible in the winter, but actually in those are what they use in the warm season. And in the winter, they retreat to tree cavities because they're more protected, they're more warm. And right now, they're pregnant, about to give birth, and soon to have little baby squirrels. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about tree cavities because it's something, again, that we can take for granted. But they really are a very precious commodity for wildlife of all kinds. Mary Holland, who's a frequent contributor to the Hudson River Almanac, Dwayne mentioned earlier, she says that it's been estimated that a quarter of northeastern forest wildlife species need trees with cavities. So that's a lot, like a quarter of species. And, and with birds, which of course is my particular predilection, you have two kinds, not to get too nerdy on you here, but there's two kinds of nest cavity needing birds. You have primary cavity nesters and secondary cavity nesters. And the basic difference is, can you do it yourself, right? So woodpeckers, we know, they've got a hard beak, they wrap their tongue around their brain, so that for cushioning, you know, they can dig a hole into a tree. But few species can do that. So all those other dozens, perhaps hundreds of species have to rely on a naturally created cavity. Maybe a branch fell off, a tree grew weird, or a woodpecker was kicked out or abandoned its nest. And so, we're talking about nuthatches, chickadees, wrens, owls, even some kinds of ducks, wood ducks. There's a ton of birds and other animals that the limiting factor for them in the environment might not be food. It might not be, you know, any of the other things you might expect. It might actually just be, are there enough holes in a tree nearby that they need to stay safe, to raise their young? And then this includes, mammals bigger than birds too, fishers, raccoons. We talked about squirrels, possums, even porcupines, need to take advantage of these. And so it's one of those things where, especially when you're talking about, if you've got a little chunk of woods, if you've got some trees in your backyard, sometimes a tree will die. And from the human perspective, maybe it looks like a hazard or an eyesore. Actually, many times a dead standing tree is ecologically more valuable than it even was when it was alive. Because from insects to birds to mammals, everybody's going to take advantage of that tree. So anyway, that's my nature nerd plug for dead trees, snags, and cavities.
And then also people are putting, nest boxes are, something that people, it's like a makeshift tree cavity, right? Like for people who want to, might not have that dead snag of a tree in their backyard, but want to provide that habitat for those species that you were just mentioning.
Absolutely. And this is the time of year, so we've just turned March. The birds are starting to get a little frisky. The squirrels, as Dwayne mentioned, are getting pregnant. This is the time of year, if you're interested, to order one, look around. We have an incredible bird store just to the south of us in Tilson. Mm-hmm. That I would highly recommend. But it's a great gift to give to put up a nest box in your backyard and, do a little research and figure out kind of what angle to put it at and what height to put it at. But March is the perfect time of year to put a nest box up wherever you live. And there are lots of creatures that might take advantage of it. And then it's a really fun thing. It is a particular delight if you've got a nuthatch or a bluebird or somebody who comes in and moves into your nest box, and you get to watch that whole progression through spring and then the babies coming out. It's a pretty satisfying thing.
Why did you mention the orientation and the, like, I put one up and no one has taken advantage of it, but.
Well, bless his heart. Yeah, it might not have been in quite the right height or orientation. But it's true. Yeah, if you're a bird, and we've seen them do this right in our backyard, they come in, they investigate, And they poke around and they look, and they're looking for different things, right? Like, is it high enough off the ground that, you know, a mammal may have a hard time being a predator, a snake? Is it faced the right way? And that in a winter storm, they're not going to get deluged with water. They are looking for some particular things about shelter and you know, and height and position. So those are things you do want to consider. Also, the fact of a cavity is precious enough that sometimes those details don't matter. Sometimes they're just like, this one looks good. Mm-hmm. But generally they don't like it to hang. Like some people like the aesthetics of like a, you know, a hanging box. That is immediately recognized as sketchy by most birds. They don't, they're like, this isn't safe. They want it affixed firmly to whatever, whether it's a fence or a tree or something like that.
And so, but not all birds are going to nest in a nest box. So they've got to be cavity nesters, and that's certain types of species. And what other kind of nests are there?
Well, before I answer that question, I will just say that like the eastern bluebird, again, something that we can take, you know, for granted sometimes, is an incredible success story of a bird that was, you know, had a massive population crash decades ago. And we are seeing a major rebound of their populations. And a lot of that has been because the widespread, it became very popular for farmers, for you know, just people with a backyard to put up nest boxes. And that has helped result in a massive rebound in bluebird populations. And they're not just delightful, they're also insect eaters. And so, you know, from you know, mosquitoes to termites to you know, there's a lot of advantages to having bluebirds around. What was your question? The other kind of nest?
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is kind of a neat time of year when the leaves are all missing from the trees, because you can actually see nests. The whole point, you know, a bird goes to great lengths to make sure that you can't see its nest. But winter doesn't matter because they're not using it. So this is a neat time of year if you're walking around. You know, there's a lot of cup nests, which are intricately woven, usually made out of a series of materials that are kind of layered in a structure. So they'll use bigger sticks to get a hard structure on the outside. And if you've ever tried to do this, if you ever tried to weave a nest together, you will come to appreciate the incredible dexterity and you know, just artistry really that it requires to make it solid, to make it stable. And then they'll use smaller and smaller material down to grass, you know, to get to the soft part in the middle. And then for the real soft part, they'll collect fluff off of cottonwood trees. They'll take spider webs a lot of times even, and sometimes they'll pluck down from their own you know, under feathers, all these things to make that interior layer the most soft and, you know, pleasant it can be for the eggs and then the babies. And then the last thing I'll say about that, since you asked, and this is just sort of a funny one, is you wonder, like, you know, all birds poop, right? And but they got to keep that nest clean. And so baby birds have evolved with this sort of amazing and bizarre adaptation where when they're young and just little pink things without feathers, they poop in a bag. It's actually, their poop happens inside of a bag. And that means that the mom can arrive and see, oh, baby pooped. She can pick it up with her beak and throw it out the nest. Mm. And the nest stays clean, because otherwise it would become
gross.
Gross, yeah. And so there's just, yeah, so many cool adaptations.
Well, and now in the winter, eagles, bald eagles in particular, you know, it's a great time to see eagles near the river. And they're already doing their business, sort of making nests and getting ready, right? Like they actually lay their eggs really early, right? Like they're one of the earlier, and they've got a different kind of nest too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, you know, bald eagles, yeah, I mean, they can build nests 6, 7, 8 feet across sometimes. They're of course amazing, huge sticks that they can put together. And yeah, we mentioned, I think, a couple times on this show, there's a few nests. There's a bit of a tradition not to give exact details about where a nest is located, just for unfortunate things that have happened in the past. But suffice it to say, there are a number of active bald eagle nests from Poughkeepsie to closer to Kingston. Some of them have, and I don't have the URL, but I could probably try to share it if people are interested, but some of them have cameras on them, and they do. They start to nest even as early as January, and then even if it's a snowstorm, they will sit all the way through. And, you know, the way that birds do it, and this is true for chickens, it's true for just about most birds, it takes a lot of energy to lay an egg, you can imagine, to create that entire, embryo covered in a shell. So they can only do it at most once a day, really probably takes them a couple days to make each egg. And so they don't want to start sitting on the egg right away, because if they did that, then the eggs would hatch out of sync. And you don't want to have a giant bird and a little bird. The big one will kill the little one. Anyway, it's a problem. So they wait until all the legs are laid, and then they start to sit. And then that way they all incubate in sync, and they all hatch in sync. And that's the way that you get.
The viability of the first egg is fine until the other ones, like.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, and that's the reason, actually my mom just found a rogue chicken that invaded her backyard, and she didn't find the nest until it already had like 10 eggs laid in it. But she looked and checked because she wanted to eat them. There was no rooster involved. And they were all fine, because even the one laid 10 days ago was fine, because it's waiting. The U.S. is one of the only places that refrigerates eggs. If you leave the country and shop for eggs, you usually find them just like on the shelves, because they don't need,
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting kind of factoid, is that, when I've thought of like a nest full of little chicks, that they all kind of were laid at the same time, but no, because of the energy it takes. Yeah, a little bird isn't just pumping out 4 eggs in a day. Interesting. Well, there are other nests that are being created in spring, but by a whole other type of animal, the amphibians that are starting to emerge in late winter and early spring, so March, which I think is something that not everybody thinks about, that, in late winter, to think of those little soft-bodied creatures, amphibians, the salamanders and frogs, starting to do their thing. And Laurel, you interviewed conservation scientist Alex Wolf earlier in the winter here, and they were talking about the vernal pools and this really unique thing that starts to happen in late winter, which is, they call it the big night, but it's really about this other emergence in late winter and early spring.
Yeah, it's really cool, and we are already reaching that time when these amphibians are starting to emerge, and there's so many species we in the area that we live, between frogs, salamanders, turtles, the reptiles and amphibians are quite diverse, and they come out earlier than my intuition would think of for a cold-blooded animal, which really starts right about now. And everybody is familiar with like the spring peepers. You can't ignore them when they first emerge. There's just this deafening sound, and then as we move through the season, you've got leopard frogs, it goes on and on and on. And vernal pools are very particular ecological phenomenon. Vernal basically just means temporary.
Spring.
Well, yeah, in this case.
Vernal, I think the word vernal.
Yeah, I think that, that's interesting. I think sometimes, I think sometimes they're called vernal pools when they occur in other seasons. Like in the Southwest, you have monsoons, which is in the summer. But anyway, yeah, vernal.
Temporary. Because fish can't typically live in these temporary pools, which also means that they, because fish will eat, salamander eggs or frog eggs. And so I think that they're kind of a unique habitat for amphibians, because they're you know, there aren't those year-round predators like fish that would just like eat up an egg mass of the frogs. And so this temporary, and so as the snow melts and the ground thaws, it just kind of creates this very unique condition for these little critters.
Yeah, and vernal pool, you know, we start every program here on Nature Nuggets, which if you're just tuning in, is what you're listening to. You know, talking about how, you know, people, you know, won't fight for what they don't know, and they can't know what, I mean, they won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. And vernal pools are a perfect example of that, because they are temporary by nature. They are often not protected under some of the same laws and you know, considerations of other wetlands. So as far as development or, you know, other threats that face them, but in fact, many species depend on them for their entire existence. And so a giant driver of extinction is the destruction of these vernal pools. And we have a lot of cool examples of them around here. Even Black Creek Preserve is a great place to go for a walk. And there's these sort of tiers of elevation. And as you walk through the forest, you'll see these ponds. And they just naturally collect rainwater. And then some of the year they're dry, but this time of year and going into the next couple months, they become absolutely alive and with sound and song. It's a really neat thing to see.
And they're really sensitive too. I mean, I think that's the thing for folks, you know, when you do see these vernal pools, is to kind of respect them, give them their space, because they are, you know, essentially they're hatcheries. They're full of egg masses from these amphibians, and the ground is really soft. And again, mud season, you know, the soil compaction and the messiness of humans tromping through wet ground, you know, could be really destructive too for all that life that's starting to emerge even in late winter here. But yeah, the evening rain too, so it's like temperature above 40 degrees and the thawed ground and then evening rain. It's like all the right conditions for all of those amphibians to get on the move, you know, which is that's what's happening right now. We're going to have some colder days still, but that general shift is signaling to all of those creatures who have been, you know, in torpor, asleep. I think there's a separate word for amphibians who just like
brumation.
Yeah. For those critters that just spend the winter pretty much almost dead, but you know, when these conditions start to shift, they just turn back on and do their thing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, we had a guest on a while back, Justin Wexler, who was describing the way that humans that were, you know, indigenous to this region, the Lenape, handled winter. And it helped me really change my perspective, because I've had a battle with accepting winter and trying to embrace it. And it's a fight that I've realized, you know, I'm not going to win. So, you know, better start to learn about it. And I used to just think about that, you know, the people who lived here, it must have been a terrible thing to have to be outside and exposed to the elements during winter. And he gave a totally different perspective. And he had studied this for a long time, and he's talked to, you know, the descendants of people here. And he said, no, actually, winter was a treasured time when, you know, all the work of summer and fall, of putting away food, you know, of drying meat, of storing nuts, you know, all of the things you needed to do. Then in winter, you got to live off of all of that work. And so you had a cozy, you kept a fire going, you built a cozy structure. And that's when you got to connect with family. It's when you got to do ceremony, and you got to actually relax. And then there was hunting, but hunting was easier because you can track animals in the snow better. And he just gave me a totally different perspective on winter that not to overly romanticize it, but that by and large, people who lived here thought of it as a treasured time, you know, when you actually got to chill out and you know, off of the hard work that you'd done. And
well, as you do, you often escape the depths of winter and you know, returned back to Kingston for mud season and this shifting into March. And there just this last week too, I was part of this really interesting conversation that's happening here in Kingston that relates to this this building of relationship to nature. And again, oftentimes we think about, you know, the summer being that key time, but it really is around us all the time. And there's this new initiative called Nature Everywhere that is starting here in Kingston. And there's a handful of different organizations that are sort of spearheading this initiative. It's Wild Earth, it's the Y Farm, it's Cornell Cooperative Extension, the City of Kingston, and the Kingston City School District. And its sort of mission is that all Kingston youth have a meaningful connection to nature. And that can play out in many different ways. And so I was fortunate to be called in to be part of this first sort of ideation and visioning. So that there were about almost 40 people that they gathered to sort of start this conversation of, you know, what does Nature Everywhere mean for Kingston and for that experience of youth. And so it's part of the Children in Nature Network, which is a national network. And so if folks are interested, you know, in being part of this conversation and being a stakeholder in what this means, because it was, you know, there were scientists and educators and farmers and conservationists and all these people coming together to help define what this means, like not just as a sort of protection of nature or an observation, but really as an action, you know, as a community to bring in that perspective and that relationship into. You know, the focus on youth is intentional, but it's really for everybody. And, you know, youth, one, kind of changing that relationship early on that someone has to more than human life can really change conservation behavior generationally, you know, because, you know, it's like you can't teach an old dog new tricks. It's humans are, you know, sometimes similar. And so really interesting. If folks want to get involved or learn more, you can go to wildearth.org/nature-everywhere. So if you just go to the Wild Earth website, you can learn more. But I think Nature Nuggets, this show every Saturday, could be a really great forum for this conversation, because it just really dovetails with the observation and the growing intimacy that this show brings into the airwaves and into people's homes and ears every Saturday. And so that conversation is getting a little bit bigger here in Kingston, which is great, and grateful to have so many activated people in this community that are really caring about that relationship. As you know, we don't really focus on the doom and gloom of climate change and the biodiversity crisis on this show, but it's real, and it, you know, it's really gonna take a transformational shift in the way we think and the way we relate to Earth to kind of ebb the tide a little bit on the impacts.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Dwayne. And you know, I will make sure to put that link that he just mentioned into the archive, which is a good reminder for folks that if you just have heard a little piece of this conversation and you want to hear the whole thing, or if you want to check out past episodes, there's dozens and dozens. We've talked to all kinds of scientists and artists and academics and, you know, fascinating, passionate nature nerds every week on this program. You can find all of those are archived at radiokingston.org under the show name Nature Nuggets. We also have Instagram presence where we post, you know, some observations every week, and also, you know, links to the show. And that is on Instagram at the handle @HVNatureNuggets. And then if you want to contact us directly, we have an email as well. So if you have a burning question that you're wondering about the natural world that we might be able to help answer, or if you want to suggest a guest, you can email us naturenuggets@radiokingston.org. And, we will be returning to this conversation just momentarily, but we're going to take a final moment to hear some more words from our community.
What does community radio mean to you?
Well, community radio is more than just human. So we involve all of Earth and who we're speaking of, to and for.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices, one community.
Hi, I'm Kristen Kessler from the City of Kingston's Department of Health and Wellness. We'd like to invite you to Kingston Eats the citywide Harvest of the Month campaign, we're celebrating healthy, local food is fun. This year, we're focusing on the abundance that is grown near us in the Hudson Valley. Look for upcoming Harvest of the Months like potatoes, beans, asparagus, and more. As always, there will be menu specials at local restaurants, free produce at participating local food pantries, free cooking workshops, and fun school-based and daycare activities for our youngest community members. If you can't make it out to a special event, you can also find Kingston Eats online on Facebook and Instagram at LiveWellKingston and using the hashtag KingstonEatsFresh. You can get more information on participating locations when you click Eat Well at LiveWellKingston.org.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices.
Many voices.
Many voices.
One community.
Stepping out on a Saturday night.
Hi, I'm John Blue. Each Saturday night between 6 and 8, it's Blues People. 2 hours of blues, traditional, electric, acoustic, classic, and new. It's Blues People with me, John Blue. Each Saturday night between 6 and 8, 1490 AM and 107.9 FM, anytime at RadioKingston.org.
Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm one of your hosts, Laurel Sutherland, and I'm joined today in the studio by Duane Martinez, who's doing the heavy lifting today for our show. And we've been having a wide-ranging conversation about what's happening in the natural world of the Hudson Valley and the Catskills, at this point in late winter. I was about to say early spring, but I might be getting a little carried away by saying that.
Yeah, well, and you just got back from a big trip. You were on the other side of the planet in Thailand. And so, you know, I was wondering if you might be able to bring a little bit of your observations from that trip to the listeners here in Kingston. What were some of the highlights?
Oh, gosh, sure. I mean, yeah, I was brought there. My professional world, I work for an organization called Rainforest Action Network. It's a global conservation human rights organization. And we've become sort of, you know, so global that we have teams in Asia, in the United States, in Europe, and we literally can't ever even speak together at the same time because of the time zones. And so we've got to get together at least once a year to strategize and you know, build our team. And so we did that this year in Thailand. And I thought it would be criminal to just, you know, fly home right after the meeting instead of staying for a while. And so I did, and I got to visit a couple amazing places. And I went up to northern Thailand around Chiang Mai. And actually, again, with the brain scramble that is time zones, and I think it was technically yesterday, no, day before, that I was went on a trip to go see elephants. I went to a preserve, which is a very ethically sort of oriented sanctuary for wild elephants that have been, you know, captured or put into, circus environments or trekking environments and then now have been liberated. And being with an elephant, I mean, it's just incredible. They're such emotional, intelligent, bizarre creatures that to be right next to them is a really neat thing. And I got to experience something in particularly cool, which was seeing this woman singing to them. I turned a corner and saw this very small statured woman sort of humming and singing very organically. And these elephants, I watched them gather from all around. There were some of them who heard her voice and they came literally running like a dog. And they gathered around her. They started wrapping their trunks around her. And then they started vocalizing to her. And I learned who she was. And her name is Lek Shailert. She's a bit of a legend. She's known as the Elephant Whisperer of Thailand. And she has dedicated her whole life to these animals, to raising the conservation of wild elephants, but also specifically to the plight of the abuse of captive elephants, and she's rescued hundreds of them herself, but then been responsible for the well-being of thousands more. And there's a lot of documentaries about her. If you look up Elephant Whisperer or Lek Shailert, you'll find her. But I was just so honored to be able to witness not just the, you know, technical parts of what she does, but the true emotional bond of, you know, her singing and watching these elephants run towards her and wrap themselves around her. It was an obvious affection that they had for her. I put tears in my eyes. It was a really neat thing.
That's really cool. And elephants, you know, these are the smaller Asian elephants, right? Like I'm not saying that they're small, but a lot of times what comes to my mind, even as you're talking, is the African elephant, but these are a little different, right?
Yes, they're a different species, but I'll tell you what, and I realize it sounds kind of like a stupid thing to say, that wow, elephants are big, but that was my initial reaction being, you know, 5 feet away from one for the first time. I was like, they were even bigger than I thought. I mean, I'm close to 6 feet tall, and if I reach my hands above my head, I could probably reach 8 feet, and I couldn't reach to the back of one of them. Like, so they're, you know, and these are females, because the males are actually quite aggressive, and even a captively raised one, you can't have them mixed. They might just kill you.
These are all females.
Yeah. There were some males, but they were either babies or behind a wall, because it is just a case that, yeah, a male elephant might just kill you. Yeah. So these are all females, but even the females, some of them, their back were, 9 feet tall. Just incredible creatures.
And so that's close to the equator, Thailand, but you're in northern Thailand, right? So mountains and rainforest, is that?
Yeah. In fact, I went on a bird trip, because I'm a bird nerd, and I went to the highest mountain in Thailand. It's in a national park called Doi Intanon. And we went actually to the highest peak in Thailand, and I saw dozens of life birds. For the non-bird nerds, a life bird is a bird that you've never seen before in your life. So it often called lifers. So it's, you know, this can only happen once per bird, because it, you know, and so it's very exciting to see a bird you've never seen before. And I saw many. I saw a collared falconet, which is a falcon the size of a sparrow. So if you've seen like a house sparrow or something around town, this is a 5 to 6 inch falcon. Very adorable. And I saw a sunbird. And this bird only lives in the entire world, Intanon sunbird, on the top of this one mountain. And the incredible thing about it, which really was a sort of a bizarre and unexpected connection to the Hudson Valley, was that because, you know, elevation kind of works like latitude, in the sense that the higher up a mountain you go, it's sort of like going north in you know, on the planet. And so at the top of this mountain, which is close to 9,000 feet, even though it's tropical, there were oaks, there were pines, and specifically there were rhododendrons. And, you know, that is something that, you know, obviously you can see around here if you go into the forest. And this is a bird, is a rhododendron obligate, which means just tightly associated species with rhododendron forests.
Wait, this was the sun?
Intanon sunbird.
Yeah. What is that?
Green-tailed sunbird. They don't have hummingbirds in Asia, but this is their kind of analogy. It's similar to a hummingbird in the sense that they, you know, they feed off of flowers. They'll often hover in place. But they also are just rainbow colored. Like, this particular bird had literally every color of the rainbow. It had green, it had blue, it had orange, it had red. It was iridescent. It was, an incredible bird. And, I would say it's one of the rarest birds I've ever seen, except if you go to the exact right place, which is the top of this one particular mountain, they're common. So, I don't know if that's still a rare bird, but you have to be in that exact place to see them.
Well, and there are birds with kind of similar conditions here in the Hudson Valley, right? We've talked about the Bicknell's thrush, which kind of has a similar, although they're not as brightly colored and maybe harder to identify, but they're also kind of on the tops of mountains, right? Like, if you can go...
Absolutely, and further south of us in the Appalachians, you've got the Swainson's warbler, which is also... deeply associated with rhododendrons, but different part of the world, different habitat. Well, we've reached the top of the hour. Dwayne, I really thank you for helping to lead the show today. And we hope that you will tune in every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. because we've got more to bring you for Nature Nuggets on Radio Kingston.
Completely on.